This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Allison Stewart in Washington. Neil Conan is away. Not a foe, not quite a friend. At one point in our career paths or some organization we might belong to, many of us have encountered a hybrid colleague known as the frenemy. Alliances with them can be awkward, forced, and often rooted in some bitter rivalry. President-elect Barack Obama is searching for common ground with former rival Republican Senator John McCain. They met yesterday for a discussion about working together in some way, as well as for a photo op. The Democratic president-elect has said he would like Republicans to serve in his administration. Today, we're talking about frenemies, the unofficial portmanteau of friend and enemy, when foes turn into friends and vice versa. Also, a little bit later in the show, we'll look at billionaire Mark Cuban. He's just been hit by the SEC with insider trading charges. But first, have you experienced the frenemy in the office, in social circles, in your neighborhood? And how do you deal with them? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Let's go now to Julian Zelizer. He's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. He joins us from their studios in Princeton, New Jersey. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about how common is it for a presidential elect to turn around and make friends with rivals?
Well, I wouldn't say it's common, but there have been moments in the 20th century, for example, where we've seen this. One example is Franklin Roosevelt. After he wins in 1940, he wins re-election. His opponent, Wendell Willkie, a Republican, goes around the world supporting his foreign policies and championing America's intervention in the world. So that's one example in 1940 where we saw this kind of unusual alliance take place right after an election.
Why do these alliances happen? Is it a matter of mutual need?
Yeah, usually, I mean, people don't do this to be altruistic. I think in general, you know, either you have a case where the opponent really supports a policy and thinks it's the right thing for the country, but often it's a marriage of convenience. So one example was Dwight Eisenhower, a Republican president elected in 1952, he teams up with Lyndon Johnson, who is the Senate minority leader for the Democrats, and they find that they can work together and advance each other's mutual interests at the same time.
That's so funny because there's this quote. I was on the website of the Eisenhower Museum, and it's about Lyndon Johnson. It says, "Eisenhower considered Lyndon Johnson to be phony, unreliable, and opportunistic. He was repelled by the Texan's undue familiarity, peculiarly his habit of backslapping. Eisenhower, as president, however, often counted on Johnson's support in the Senate. In turn, Johnson harbored great respect for Eisenhower and sought his advice through his own presidency." Is that all true?
That's exactly true, at least in the first few years when Democrats didn't control Congress. What happened was, you know, Eisenhower had a problem. There were a lot of Republicans who were kind of isolationist, and they didn't support strong executive power on national security. They were trying to pass all kinds of legislation that would limit the ability of the president to enter into treaties overseas. And so who did he turn to? Not to Republicans in the Senate, but to Lyndon Johnson, who was willing to round up votes and make the Republicans on Capitol Hill look like the obstructionists. And Eisenhower got the legislation he wanted. So it was true. As time progressed, they fought more often, and they weren't quite the best allies by the end of the 1950s.
And President Johnson, in turn, had a similar relationship with another senator.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Johnson really relied on bipartisanship in two different cases. The first was in 1964, he wants to pass civil rights to end public segregation. And who are the biggest opponents? Southern Democrats. So who does he turn to end a filibuster in the Senate? Everett Dirksen, an Illinois senator, a Republican, who was willing to support civil rights. And it's because of Dirksen that the filibuster in the summer of 64 ends and we get civil rights legislation. He then relies on Dirksen for a different issue, Vietnam. Republicans were some of the strongest supporters of the administration as they escalated the war in Vietnam. Well, many Democrats were critical of the whole effort.
Who was Harry Truman's frenemy?
Oh, Arthur Vandenberg. Arthur Vandenberg was a Michigan senator who in 1940 was pretty much an isolationist. He didn't think America should get involved in overseas conflicts, at least unless it was absolutely necessary. But by 1945, he was an interventionist. He believed World War II was the right call, and he was willing to work with Democrats. And he works with Harry Truman in 1947 and 48 to create the national security state that we have now, the CIA, the Marshall Plan. The two worked very closely, and it was a kind of famous friendship, one example of bipartisanship that we often remember.
Something, though, that's interesting about this particular case, reading up on Arthur Vandenberg, some of the work that he did unraveled after he died. So my question is, does it come down to the will of the people involved that once they step out of the equation, does it just unravel? Does it get undone?
It can very easily. I mean, Vandenberg's a great example because we often remember the Cold War and we remember the Vandenberg-Truman alliance as they got all of this stuff done. But the reality, it was of a very partisan era, and many other Republicans, didn't think much of what Vandenberg was doing. And as soon as he diminishes as a force by 1950, he's very ill. Other Republicans step in, the Richard Nixons of the GOP, and they start to really attack what the Democrats had done. So these kind of moments of bipartisanship are incredibly fragile, and it does depend on the will of the party to keep on doing whatever this alliance did. And it also depends on the alliance to create things that can be sustained over time. But they are very, very fragile.
All right, so we've just looked at the glass half full. Let's look at it half empty. Has it been detrimental to a president to bring his enemies into his cabinet, to bring his enemies on board with his agenda?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we've seen less of this, by the way, since the 1970s because Washington's become just much more polarized and partisan. So there's fewer examples where we see these alliances. But one was in 1990, and President George H.W. Bush, he formed an alliance with Dan Rostenkowski, the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, a powerful Democrat, and they passed a deficit reduction bill, which raised taxes and cut spending to lower the deficit. And many conservatives, including Newt Gingrich, were absolutely furious that President Bush had done this. They saw it as a betrayal of his famous campaign pledge in 1988, read my lips, no new taxes, and an abandonment of what Ronald Reagan had argued, that taxes should consistently go down. And afterwards, many people say that alliance was part of what cost him the 1992 election. Many conservatives didn't come out to support him.
Professor Zelizer, I'm going to ask you to hang on and take a listen to one of our listeners. Her name is Audrey, calling in from Minnesota. And Audrey, you were an elected official?
I was for 7 years in Minneapolis, and I was on the Minneapolis school board.
And did you find yourself in this position where you needed to put your arm around someone that maybe you just didn't care for a whole heck of a lot?
On several occasions, we'd had people that would come to meetings and would be very angry, yelling and screaming at us and telling us what horrible people we were, and this was on television. And as an elected official, working with the other people who were on the board with me, I found that it made great sense to go afterwards and sit down and try and talk with these folks and reason with them and find out what really was the source of their anger and their frustration. And although it didn't always work out beautifully, it certainly did help when we were in some pretty difficult times to get people to at least be able to stop with the name calling and the angry things, to sit down and try and at least come up with some solution to the problems that we were facing.
Audrey, thanks for calling. I do want to bring in Liz Ryan into this conversation. She's a workplace expert and the host of the online community site AskLizRyan.com. So, Liz, did Audrey do the right thing by sitting down and trying to have a civil conversation with these folks who were calling her names?
Oh, most definitely, Allison. For one thing, you're not going to learn what's on their mind and how you can bridge that gap between your views and their views unless you really understand where they're coming from. And if you can rise above, the fact that somebody has just insulted you to actually ask them some questions, you can cover a lot of ground. But the other thing is, these are public proceedings, and you want to show people that someone insulting you or dissing you, even publicly, isn't grounds for you to completely shut them out, which isn't very, of course, statesmanlike behavior.
Professor Zelizer, it's interesting this we talked about being able to have an insult roll off your back, and I'm thinking about Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, who and John McCain, all of whom said lots of things about one another. We were talking about mutual need at the top. What is the need of President-elect Obama to have McCain and Clinton closer, and what's their need of him?
Well, he needs, I'd say, John McCain. He probably won't have a filibuster-proof Senate, so he'd like as much Republican support as he can get to make sure that legislation he's pushing through is not stifled. And even if he had a filibuster-proof Senate, I think he'd like legislation that has some bipartisan support. You know, that's a way to pass things that are going to last over time rather than, as we said earlier, be dismantled very quickly. So as a president who wants to kind of do a bold agenda and really create a new era in American politics, I think that's very attractive to him. For Hillary Clinton, he wants to obviously diminish any lingering tensions in the Democratic coalition. He comes into office in the worst of times. The economy is in bad shape. We have instability overseas. We have a financial shortfall. So he needs all Democrats on board. And there's a lot of Republicans who are going to be out to get him. And so I think part of the idea is by bringing her on board, there's an attractive kind of tent-building, coalition-building quality of making that kind of appointment, beyond her obvious skills and expertise. For them, they want influence. You know, for John McCain, I think it's both a matter of influence for the GOP, but also for himself. You know, his image has really been harmed, I think, in many ways by the campaign. He came out more partisan, more negative. And so the idea of being the maverick again, being the guy who shepherds legislation through, can be very attractive to him, thinking of his legacy.
Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School. He joined us from the studios in Princeton, New Jersey. Thanks so much for being with us, Professor.
Thank you.
Liz Ryan, I'm going to ask you to stay with us because we're still going to talk about frenemies in the office, next door to you, down the street. How do you handle them? Keep them close or stay away? 1-800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. I'm Allison Stewart. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Allison Stewart in Washington, D.C. So far, we've talked a lot about dealing with political rivals. Not all of us can be president, though. Instead, we get to deal with office politics and frenemies closer to home in our social circles and in our neighborhoods. Please tell us your stories. Have you experienced the frenemy? How did you deal with him? Are you one yourself? Our number here in Washington is 1-800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. You can always join the conversation over at the website. Go to npr.org and just click on Talk of the Nation. I'd like to bring back into the conversation now Liz Ryan. She is a workplace expert and host of the online community site AskLizRyan.com. She joins us from member station KGNU in Boulder, Colorado. Hi, Liz.
Hi, Allison.
So let's define some terms quickly. When we're talking about frenemies for most people, what are we talking about? What is the relationship?
Okay. A frenemy relationship is one where you have a person that you would, all other things being equal, consider a friend. But you don't consider them a friend because you've had at least one experience with this person, which was surprising in a negative way, right? It could be as subtle as a person surprised you by being rude unexpectedly or sort of being mean to you or doing something that wasn't very friendly, or it could be as overt as being stabbed in the back at work. But a frenemy is a person that you would consider a friend based on your day-to-day interaction, except for the fact that they have a habit or at least one incident of surprising you with something really negative in the friendship department.
And somehow, I'm guessing with a frenemy, you have to deal with this person on some level.
Right. Well, that's the thing. You know, you have President-elect Obama putting together a cabinet, and I think it's fantastic and praiseworthy that he's pulling in as many, you know, differing views as he can, which could involve having people of all different political stripes. But the fact is that he's the boss. when you're at work and you work among frenemies, and most of us will at some point or another, you're not necessarily the boss. If you were, you'd have a lot more influence on the situation. Often, in the office or in the workplace, we're forced to work among people that we just don't feel that good about and we may not trust.
It's interesting you should mention the boss, because we have Marie from one of the great cities in America, Austin, Texas, whose boss was the frenemy. Hi, Marie.
How you doing?
Good. This sounds slightly dangerous to have the boss as a frenemy. What happened?
Well, I just graduated from college, and I went to work for, this was an office, I went to work for the lieutenant governor. I won't mention which lieutenant governor, but it's been a while back. This happened in my early 20s, and I'm in early 40s now. And I was black. She was black. I was really looking forward to the friendship because I thought that I was looking forward to her being actually my mentor. Mm-hmm. And we would go out to lunch, but I don't think she liked me really at all. We were only two blacks in the office. She was really my enemy. I think when I look back on that, she was really my enemy. And I like I said, we were all young in that office. I had just graduated. She was older, and she would do things like make me the messenger, like, you know, to deliver messages to different people. I asked her once, why would you pick me? You know, I'm trying to move up. I just graduated. There are other people here that are still in college, and she didn't know what to say. She didn't have a reason for why she would choose me. You know, I want people to see me just graduate to move up. And I stayed there about a year or so, and I ended up going to law school. I'm a solo practitioner now. Mm-hmm. I think the bottom line was that I don't want a boss. I don't want to play all those office games. I like being my own boss.
All right, Marie, thank you so much for sharing your story. Liz, question, should you confront a frenemy the way that Marie did, went to her boss and asked her, why are you making me do these things which reflect badly on me?
Well, that's a great question, Allison. I mean, when it's your boss who's the frenemy or who's sending out that hostile vibe, the question is, what are the stakes? Mm. If you can afford, and Marie had choices, and hats off to her, she had plan B to go back to law school. If you have choices like that, absolutely. You can, you know, put the issue on the table and say to your boss or say to a coworker, I'd really like to straighten out some things between us because your behavior has confused me at times. The challenge is that some of us don't always have those choices in the workplace, particularly when the boss is the problem individual. Because if you bring the issue out, you may be forcing it to a head, and you may be the loser in that situation.
So you need to be prepared for the worst case scenario if you're going to go for the confrontation route.
Well, the other issue with the outright discussion is that there are frenemies, there are manipulative people, unfortunately, in some workplaces who relish the soap mm-hmm. opera and the drama. You know, this is something else about President-elect Obama, is that he opted for a no-drama campaign. And there are plenty of workplaces that are full of drama and soap opera, theatrics all the time. And there are people that would love nothing better than to get embroiled in a conversation with you about the nature of your relationship. And why were you mean to me at that meeting last Thursday? And why did you talk behind my back? And sometimes the best option is to stay completely clear of that.
As long as we're talking about drama, let's talk about it literally. We're going to talk to Lee in Oakland, who works in the theater. Hi, Lee.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing good.
I work in the theater as an actor and a director, which is a very political sphere. And often during an audition process, it can be a lot like a political campaign with lots of bickering and trash talking going on. And then, you know, as the results come in and you look at the cast list up on the board, which is a lot like election night, waiting for the results to come in, one of your frenemies might have a better role than you or a worse role than you. And then that dynamic will step into the production of the play itself. And sometimes that dynamic of the frenemy will help the play, and sometimes it'll hurt the play.
All right, Lee, thank you so much for calling us. Question for you, Liz. Is there a time when you shouldn't reach out to the frenemy in the workplace? It should just be the conflict that should remain unspoken.
Absolutely. You know, as I mentioned, there are people who create that frenemy relationship in order to have control over you, right? So a lot of the frenemy dynamic is a person who wants to keep you guessing. They want you to wonder, am I on Susie's good side or her bad side today? And when you spot that kind of behavior, it's a very good idea to to negate it, to step away from it and say, you know what, I am not going to let her push those buttons with me, him or her. I'm going to stay clear of that. We're going to deal on a sort of a business-like level, and I'm going to let all the rest of the stuff wash over me, because very often that's the motivation behind the frenemy behavior, is to have a little control over someone.
Rich in Chicago, he has a method for dealing with frenemies. Hi, Rich.
Yeah, hi there. You know, I'm going to make a frenemy out of Neil by saying, Allison, you can host the show anytime. You're doing a fantastic job.
Thank you.
And something back that Liz was talking about, bosses. My frenemy was a boss. I'm no longer with the company, but I used to kill them with kindness. I mean, when they're your boss, you really have nowhere to go but where they tell you to go. And a lot of times when they're giving you a directive and they're expecting you to go one way and all of a sudden you go their way, they've got nowhere to go with it. Nowhere to go with it. And it works for me, it works in personal relationships and business relationships. Just kill them with kindness and they are almost sit there left stuttering like they don't know quite what to do.
Good advice from Rich in Chicago. Thanks, Rich.
Thanks a lot.
We're also going to stay in the Windy City and talk to Bill for a moment. Bill has a question. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Great topic today. What I was going to say is, what do you do when you find yourself in the situation of being between frenemies, the person who gets dragged into the drama in the workplace? We've all worked places where you wind up expected to take a side, and you never know a win-win situation, especially if you throw in the complication of what if the boss is one of the people? Are you expected to side with the boss? Are you expected to side with the coworker? Then everybody's feelings get hurt. It's a great topic, and I'm just wondering what strategies you have for those of us who choose not to engage.
Liz, what can you offer Bill?
Oh, Bill, this is such a great topic. You know, in general, when people or groups are at war in the workplace, you have to get your Swiss citizenship right away. You have to be Swiss. And I don't mean that in a wimpy way, with the no slur on the Swiss, of course. I mean in a very steadfast way, in a very forthright way, you say, I hear the conflict, I see it, it's not my conflict. You don't pass judgment on the relative merits of one side's case or the other side's case. You say, I hear that. I'm sorry that you guys don't see eye to eye. I don't have time or mental energy to buy into that. When it's your boss, obviously, it's a little more complicated because there are plenty of bosses that give points for loyalty and take away points for disloyalty. But I think you can be a trusted advisor to your boss. And if you really want to put a stake in the ground around your own voice at work, you can say to your boss, you know, in general, I agree with you about a lot of this stuff, Chuck, but I got to tell you, I think you're missing the boat. Gary has some really good feedback. And, you know, because of the conflict between you, I think at times you may miss that. You could surprise yourself by being a little forthright about something like that and actually gaining credibility.
Well, Ron from Columbia, South Carolina poses another. He wants to add another wrinkle to it. What if the frenemy is in the family? Hi, Ron.
How you doing?
I'm doing okay. So who's the frenemy that you've been dealing with?
Well, the frenemy is my cousin, and he's my best friend, one of my best friends. We care very much about each other, but he has ways of throwing you under the bus to other people, pointing out your negative spots, bad spots, which we all carry. And what I've found is by trying to reduce my negative exposure to him and I hope Liz can give me some advice, I try not to avoid him because we do have a pretty good relationship when we're one-on-one or in a group. But what I've tried to do is just reduce the exposure of my negative side. You know, if I have something bad going on in my life, I just don't talk about it or discuss it. As a matter of fact, I try to cloak it. And the last point I want to make is I don't always think frenemies are being malicious. Sometimes I think people are making conversation or one-upping themselves and not realizing that they're actually putting you down. And I love you guys again.
All right, Ron, thanks so much. I also want to talk to Matthew because Matthew has a similar situation. It's somebody in the family who's kind of a problem. Hi, Matthew. You're calling from Ann Arbor?
Yes. Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. What do you need some help from Liz with?
Well, it's my sister-in-law, and I honestly like her, and we actually get along, but whenever she's angry with my brother, she tends to project that anger towards me, or she's often rude. And my question is, how exactly do I deal with that? Because I'm sort of at a point where it could be a point of contention in my family, and I just recently listening to the show realized that she's actually my frenemy, but she's also my sister-in-law. What's the best way to approach that?
All right, Matthew, thanks for calling. Liz, what do you do when it's a family member? We're all coming home for Thanksgiving soon. Better run into
right.
the family frenemy.
Well, for Ron and Matthew, I would say, first of all, you are not alone. I don't think there is more frenemyism anywhere outside the family than maybe high school. High school is the epicenter of frenemy behavior, and that's a whole other topic. But frenemies in families, very, very common, because family relationships are complicated. You know, we spend a lot of time oftentimes with our family members. We're expected to be really ourselves with them. But as Ron pointed out, if you let down your guard sometimes, or you say something that you're not necessarily proud of, things aren't going perfectly in your life, that can be used against you, right? And you can get it thrown right back in your face, or you can hear it repeated by someone that you really would rather didn't get that news. So I think the key with frenemies in the family is when they overstep their bounds. And just as Matthew said, I don't think it's necessarily malicious. It could just be unguarded speech. It could be naivete. Is that you set that boundary right then and there. So I think it's much easier to deal with that in the clinch, in the moment, than to have a serious sit down and say, you know, at times you disappoint me and your behavior is confusing. If you happen to become aware of something that's happened, a bunch of people that you went to high school with are aware of your, you know, unfortunate marital situation, thanks to your sister-in-law, before you, you know, were willing to talk about it, you say to her, you know what? That was not cool. I don't appreciate that. I didn't tell you that so you could spread it around to people. And what'll happen is, if you do that again, I won't be able to confide in you at all.
Shut it down. We're talking to Liz Ryan about the issues of frenemies in the workplace and in your life. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart. We're speaking with Liz Ryan, a workplace expert, about frenemies. And Liz, we got an email from Josh in Phoenix. He's pointing out the upside of frenemies. He wrote to us, over the course of my career, I found that frenemies have been overall beneficial for my career. They've pushed me, they've prodded me, and they've undercut me, but all of this has required me to raise my game and in the end has contributed to my success. So frenemy, not necessarily a bad word, huh?
Well, Josh is the gentleman's name?
Yes, Josh from Phoenix.
Yeah, I would say to Josh that that's a really great observation. And as a workplace commentator myself, I'll tell you, one of the things that I regret, that I mourn the passing of, is the development over a career's time frame of the ability to deal with difficult people. And the reason that I think this is becoming less common is because, notwithstanding the tough economy right now, it's much easier and much more common today for people to leave their jobs.
Just quit.
Than it was 20 years ago. So you have a lot more job movement. And one of the reasons that people change jobs is difficult people, difficult bosses. I'm from the, you know, sort of tail end of the baby boom, early X. And I didn't feel that I had that option as a 20-something and 30-something-year-old. I stuck it out. And I dealt with some horrible people. And just as Josh said, I learned huge people skills in the process that I use today all the time. And I think that, you know, Josh makes a really good point. There's a point where your mental health and your physical health is at risk because of awful situations on the job and sleep deprivation and all that. And that's a time when it probably makes sense to move on. But short of that, if you can navigate these tricky interpersonal situations at work, it strengthens you, it helps you, and it makes you a better employee, a better manager, a better entrepreneur if you choose to go that route.
It seems like Jim from Michigan, our next caller, went that route. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
What happened?
Well, it was interesting. I was listening to the show, and I was thinking back to the middle 90s when I was a manager for General Motors in Flint, Michigan. And Flint is the almost the hotbed or birthplace of the UAW.
Sure.
And at that time, you know, if you wanted to be considered a good manager, you were very hardcore about the goals of management. And if you wanted to be considered a good union representative, you were, you know, you hated management. So we both had our goals, individual goals, but at the time, just like now, we were fighting to keep the plant open. And so I had a gentleman I dealt with on the shop committee, which is what we called the union representatives, and because of the superordinate goal of keeping the plant open, even though we didn't see eye to eye in the workplace, we had to find common ground and give and take a little bit, even though we might have considered each other enemies. I think enemies might be a little strong word, but... it was interesting. The negotiation went on, and I told the screener that the other interesting thing was when we got a loan and we were out of the public eye,
yeah,
because none of the union guys would want to be seen with you publicly. But we had a lot of things in common outside the workplace, church, family, activities.
Yeah, it's true, Jim. Sometimes your frenemy really, you can put more stress on the friend part. Jim, thanks for being with us. Liz Ryan is a workplace expert and host of the online community site AskLizRyan.com. Liz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Allison.
Coming up next, the billionaire and the SEC will get an inside look at super maverick Mark Cuban and the charges of insider training. Do stay with us. I'm Allison Stewart. It is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. But right now, Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, is a billionaire and a character. Credited with turning his team around, Cuban is regularly fined for spending as much time on the court as some players, shouting down referees. But this time, he isn't in trouble with the NBA. It's the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. Based on an 8-minute and 35-second phone call placed on June 28, 2004, the SEC alleges Cuban is guilty of insider trading. They filed a civil suit in the district court in Dallas. Through his attorneys, Cuban says the case has, quote, no merit. Today, we're going to take a look at the man behind the Mavericks and get the real stats on Mark Cuban. Dave Zirin is a sports writer for The Nation magazine and author of A People's History of Sports in the United States, and he is sitting across from me in Studio 3A. Hi.
Hey, great to be here, Allison.
I want people to be able to join the conversation. If you have a question for Dave about Mark Cuban, not about this case, but about Cuban the guy, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. You can also send us an email at talk@npr.org. So Mark Cuban is what a lot of people call a self-made billionaire. Tell us, how did he make all this money?
That's a great question. I mean, he was called by USA Today the luckiest man from the dot-com era. I mean, he made $1.8 billion through a combination of his love of sports and also getting out of the dot-coms before they went dot-bomb. I mean, he was somebody who figured out the technology to be able to get people through their computer, something that seems very pedestrian now, through their computer to be able to hear games. You know, something a lot of people do. I know when I'm on the road and I want to hear a game, you know, you do live streaming mm-hmm. of the games through your computer. But hey, someone had to be the person to come up with that, and then someone had to sell before the technology got reproduced enough so it was worthless, and that was really Mark Cuban. And so Mark Cuban, in a lot of ways, is living out, you could argue, a kind of male fantasy, in that he's somebody who comes from a working class family. He got in early on the dot-com industry. He made $1.8 billion. He cashed out, and he bought a team, and he's decided to become Mr. Superfan. And it's so interesting because think about it like The Simpsons. Most pro sports owners are Montgomery Burns. I mean, they're old as Methuselah. And
Smithers?
Yes, Smithers, yes. Look at them, Smithers. You know, that's most pro sports owners. Mark Cuban is Homer Simpson. He's Homer Simpson if Homer owns a team.
Dope.
With everything that you could imagine being polarizing that would go with that.
So, Cuban, let's roll back a little bit. So he was able to sell various web entities for a lot of money when people were actually still buying them for a lot of money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they sold their company Broadcast.com to Yahoo for $5.04 billion, which is interesting because it's a ridiculous sum for a company that at the time was earning $100 million in revenue. And this is, in a lot of ways, our current economic crisis is built up because of, you have this gap between real wealth and then the assumed wealth, the stock market wealth, whether you're talking about real estate holdings or whether you're talking about internet entities. Well, Cuban was one of the people, you got to give him credit for this, who actually got out when the getting was good. And because he got out, he's decided to live the life that, as a working class kid from Pittsburgh with Coke bottle glasses, nothing against glasses, Allison, I notice you have the bespectacled set yourself, is something that he's decided to do. And he is derided in some circles, without question, for being, for lack of a better term, a kind of like a jock follower, somebody mm-hmm. who worships his athletes in a way that's unseemly. But when you talk to players themselves, and this is something I do as a sports writer, there is tremendous respect for Cuban because it's very rare that an owner actually has the kind of impact on the psychology of a franchise that Cuban had on the Mavericks. In the decade before he was there, they went 199-507, the laughingstock of the National Basketball Association. And it wasn't just that Cuban went in there and got the big money players, because that's not what he did. What he did was he made the players excited to come to work. I mean, the joke is it's the fluffy robe theory of ownership, because the joke is that all the Mavericks players have the finest robes that you could possibly imagine. And there's this sort of sewing circle pipeline among NBA players where they tell each other over their own little coffee klatches, you know, the robes we have in Dallas are just spectacular. And so then the players, they say, oh, well, maybe I should sign with Dallas.
So treat people like winners and they'll be winners?
Yes, and put some money behind it as well, including having little flat screen plasma TV, Xbox consoles in every locker room.
Wow.
Hey.
Good to work for Mark Cuban, it sounds like.
I'm telling
you. That.
I'm telling you. But some people, like, you know, the Washington Post's own Tony Kornheiser, he calls him a preening schmo. And other people swear by him. And that's the thing about Mark Cuban, is that he's a very polarizing figure. And that's why I can't imagine anybody else, any other owner in sports, if they were caught up in a $700,000 insider trading imbroglio, that it would generate the kind of coverage that this would generate. And I certainly can't imagine another owner going to war over his or her on his or her blog over the intent of the federal government in trying to indict him.
We should point this out, that, and this also speaks to Mark Cuban knowing the internet. When you type in his name into Google, his blog comes up first. Mm-hmm. Even with all of this news around him, he gets the first click.
Oh, I'll tell you, when I was first starting out as a sports writer, one of the first things I did was zap him an email saying, hey, could I interview you? I thought, what the heck? Within a couple hours, I got an email back saying, sorry, I'm too busy, but thanks for sending me an email. And I was just thinking to myself, whoa, that's pretty cool in and of itself. And I'll tell you another reason. His blog also got him in the news recently, and this is another reason why his players swear by him. You may have heard that one of his players, all-star Josh Howard, made a lot of negative news about a month back, where he was caught on someone's cell phone camera speaking in a disparaging tone about the national anthem. And the Dallas Mavericks, Mark Cuban's blog, Maverick site in particular, were flooded with emails that were not only racist, but they were also threatening. And also, in a very bizarre way, had these weird correlations about Barack Obama. This was before the election. And it was like, those N-words like Josh Howard and Barack Obama, they don't love our country, like crazy stuff. And what did Cuban do in response? He just posted all the emails on his blog with the return addresses of the people who sent him the emails. And that was something else, I'll tell you, that got some respect from people, particularly from his players, who say, you know what, Mark Cuban, he has our back.
All right, I want to go to a caller who has a question for you about Mark Cuban. This is Joe from Chicago. Joe, what's your question?
Hey, guys. How are you today?
Doing great.
Well, my question, being from Chicago, I'm sure you can guess where I'm heading with this.
I think
so. Talk around here in the summer was Cuban was in the game for the Cubs ownership. I believe that's been dispelled as of now. I'm not quite sure where it's at. Just wanted to know if this was essentially the death nail in not only the Cubs deal, but also Cuban's future prospects, maybe in getting into the Major League Baseball game. And I can take my response off the air.
All right, Joe, thanks a lot.
Terrific question. I'll tell you something. The death knell for Cuban fulfilling one of his childhood dreams and buying the Cubs, that was going to happen even before this took place. He was not going to be approved to buy the team. And he, despite the fact that he had given by far the biggest offer to buy the team.
Why wasn't he going to get it?
Because Major League Baseball, not unlike the National Football League, I mean, it is quite the cloistered club.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're talking exclusive type of situation here. We're talking a country club kind of scenario that only the best need apply and bloodlines actually count for something. And this is where you do get to that question of class. This is a working class guy who wears t-shirts to the games, who doesn't play by the rules. And they look at Mark Cuban, baseball owners, and they say, ugh, I don't want this guy anywhere near. He might steal the silverware at one of our fancy dinners. I mean, it's kind of like a Rodney Dangerfield back to school kind of thing, where mm-hmm. it's like, oh no, the slob is coming to ruin everything. But I'll tell you something. If you're a Chicago fan, you would want somebody like Mark Cuban to own your team, because he would be the sort of person who would not give a hoot about curses, about any of the horrible mass psychology that exists in the city of Chicago that turns players and managers just tighter than drums come playoff time, because they're so freaked out at being yet another year of the great curse that stands over that city. I think Mark Cuban would be the equivalent of someone like Pedro Martinez when he went to the Red Sox Sox, and he was asked about the curse of Babe Ruth that was preventing the Red Sox from winning the World Series. And he said that if I had to face against Babe Ruth, I'd plunk him right in the tush with a fastball. You know, that kind of attitude is what you kind of need sometimes to break off the mass psychology that exists in a game like baseball. Mark Cuban is not going to own the Cubs.
We're talking to Dave Zirin, sports writer for The Nation magazine, about Mark Cuban, the man making news today because the SEC has brought down civil charges against Cuban, alleging insider trading, a case that his lawyers say on his website that has no merit. It's kind of ironic in a way because what he is alleged to have done is sold just a massive amount of shares in a website,
yeah.
Mama.com, a search engine, after he allegedly received news, private news, and supposedly, if you read the indictment, you can click through, you can find it online, read the whole thing, which is sort of ironic since he made his money on the internet in the first place. But he is involved in a whole bunch of other things as well. HDNet,
mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
What
else is in his portfolio?
That's right. HDNet is a big thing, and just the whole idea of high-def television was something that he was an early person singing the praises of. But I'll tell you something else about Cuban that a lot of people don't know is that he's also a film producer, and he's put his money behind several documentaries that you would have to describe as populist or you'd have to describe as muckraking, which mm-hmm. is another thing that is not in step with ownership culture in sports. I mean, he is the person who put the money behind Good Night and Good Luck, the Oscar-winning film that George Clooney directed about McCarthyism mm-hmm. and the conflicts with Edward R. Murrow. He put the money behind The Smartest Guys in the Room, the Enron documentary. He put his money behind a pretty intense documentary called The War Within, which is about suicide bombers and attempted to look at the internal life of suicide bombers. So this is somebody who, you know, typical, just like he'll run out onto the court, he's not somebody who shies away from controversy when it comes to the money he puts behind his films as well.
He also owns the Landmark Theater chain. But we have a caller, Eric, from Orangeburg, South Carolina, who does have another question about his business. Hi, Eric.
Hello.
Hey, so what's your question about Mark Cuban?
How did Voom work out for him? Do people make money owning a professional franchise? And I'll take my answer off there.
I didn't hear the first part of the question.
Vroom, about a satellite service?
Oh, the Vroom. Yeah, I don't know a great deal about Vroom. Mm-hmm. Not an expert on Vroom. But I will say, do people make money off of professional sports franchises? Well, what's interesting is because of the web of antitrust agreements, it's actually difficult to know how much. I mean, depending on the sport and depending on where teams are with regards to their collective bargaining agreements, it is impossible to know whether teams actually make money or lose money. The thing about Mark Cuban, and I don't mean to sound like a big Mark Cuban booster. I'm actually talking more objective fact rather than my own subjective opinion about the man. But he is somebody who spends money as if he doesn't care whether he makes money when it comes to his team. And once again, that is something that endears a lot of his players toward him. A lot of people say, well, wait a minute, you can't treat players that well because then they won't work hard enough. And they point to Dallas's flameouts in the playoffs the last 2 years as evidence of that. But if you ask the players themselves, they say, you know what, it's an 82-game season, you're away from your family, it's a harder life than people know, and it's nice to have some fluffy robes.
We're talking to Dave Zirin, sports writer for The Nation magazine, about the man in the news today, Mavericks owner Mark Cuban. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart-Jones, joined by Dave Zirin, sports writer for The Nation magazine. And we're talking about Mark Cuban, who's in the news today because he has been charged with insider trading, a civil case. He's been charged by the SEC. And a couple of things about Mark Cuban. One, he was on Dancing with the Stars. Can I just bring that up?
You can. I mean, we should just talk about it on the radio. If people actually saw a clip of it, they may reach for a scalpel and go after their own eyes.
Why would he do something like that? See, is that just part of his personality?
That's what I'm saying. I mean, the way I'm describing him is somebody, oh, he supports his players. He comes from a working class background. One might think, oh, this guy must be some kind of hero. Why would anybody not like this guy? But the Dancing with Stars example is exactly why he rubs people the wrong way, why Tony Kornheiser would call him a preening Schmo repeatedly. And I mean, Rick Morrissey of the Chicago Tribune, he once wrote of Cuban, he wrote, "It's okay to be vapid as long as you're loud." But that's what that's what Cuban proves. And there's that aspect of his personality that really does rub some people the wrong way.
Well, I gotta tell you, Paul from Galveston, he's on Cuban's side. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. You've met Mr. Cuban.
I have. I'm from Galveston, Texas. I moved here from Florida, and I was on the sidelines at an NBA game, and Mr. Cuban came by, and I said, "How are you?" And he said, "Well, I'm doing well." And he was really personable with me, and I got into it with him a little bit. I asked him about NBA referees and their fairness, and he said, "You know what? They do their jobs." And I said, "Well, you know, you haven't always said that to me and to other folks." And he said, "Well, you know, I think that I think it's a tough job, and they're active." Of course, that night his team won, but I wondered what your guests said about or had to say about different things surrounding Mr. Cuban's views on basketball referees.
All right. Paul, thanks for calling.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for calling from Galveston, Texas, birthplace of Jack Johnson, first African-American heavyweight champion, not the insipid folk singer.
know where you were going with that
yeah.
one.
So to go about Cuban and refs, this is another thing. Once again, we keep going back to this point of polarization when you talk about Mark Cuban. Mark Cuban is somebody, the only owner who I could think of who has regularly stood up with David Stern, who's the most powerful commissioner in professional sports, the commissioner of the National Basketball Association. And one of the points where Cuban has been a consistent voice over the years has been on the question of NBA referees. And the man has been fined hundreds of thousands of dollars over the years for his criticisms of the refs. And when you think about this past year, the NBA was almost crippled by a refereeing scandal involving a former referee Tim Donaghy and the possibility that there were fixed NBA games and were other refs involved. It seems like that scandal has been well contained and just Donaghy alone will be the person who takes the fall. But I'll tell you something, it does make Cuban once again look somewhat prophetic, because the thing that Cuban would speak about would be the absence of oversight. And that's one thing about NBA referees, is that there is no oversight.
Just a few seconds left. Knowing what you know about Mark Cuban, he's going to fight these charges?
he will fight them to the gates of hell. You better believe it.
Dave Zirin is a sports writer for The Nation magazine and author of A People's History of Sports in the United States. He joined us from our studio here in Washington. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, my privilege, Allison. Thank you.
This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Allison Stewart in Washington.